Thank you. Listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Horn, the Head-On Radio Network. You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Six more of them in the spring. So by next May, we will have completed 12 of these two-hour chats. And what we're anticipating is that tonight's chat will be generally about the program, a little bit about the class on the founding, a little bit about the class on the 19th century America. And then the second one will be focused specifically on the class on the founding. The one after that will focus specifically on the 19th century class. Then in November, we will do the same thing. We will have one more chat devoted to the course on the founding and yet another chat focused on the 19th century. Then in December, we will hold one chat where we'll join together again and kind of talk generally about the class and what we're hoping we've accomplished at that point, which will be the halfway point in both of these classes. And then what we're anticipating is that in the first of the year, after the holidays, these two courses. Hopefully, by the time we get to next May, we will have accomplished, we think, we're anticipating some pretty impressive things. We hope so. So with that, let's talk. First of all, let me give you a couple of general pieces of information. We're going to try to do these chats at least for a while on Tuesday nights. So what we've decided, this chat will be from tomorrow night, which will be a Tuesday. It'll be the 11th of October, and we'll begin at 7 p.m., and we'll anticipate a chat that will run from 7 to 9 on the 11th, next Tuesday evening. It will focus principally on the course on the founding. We'll be talking about the literature. Actually, the first unit assignments are on there. We're going to ask our teachers to submit via email answers to some of the questions that we have. We'll get into these later on this evening. So again, then, after tonight, our next two chats will be on Tuesday nights. The first one next Tuesday, October 11th, from 7 to 9. And the one after that will be two Tuesdays after that, which will be the 25th of October, again at 7 p.m., 7 to 9. And then we'll maintain the same schedule of two chats in November, and we'll do one more early in December, well before the holidays. And then we'll take a break through the holidays and well into January before we come back. And from early in February until May, we'll recreate the same thing. And thereby, we will have completed both of these classes at the same time by the time we get through to May. So we're hoping. The other thing I want to share with you is that on the screen behind us is an email address, mramsey@concord.edu. We're going to be working out strategies to allow more direct interaction between you and us during these chats. Very honestly, we're going to be investigating the potential of Skype accounts, which will enable us to not only hear each other, but be able to see each other as well in some cases. But before we get there, for tonight at least, if you have a question or a comment that you would like to get to us, just email it to Margaret, mramsey@concord.edu. And Margaret is sitting in her office on the computer watching tonight's program. And if you send her an email, she'll get it to us. We'll get it on the air, and we'll address it for you this evening. Her office and working the computer. So if any of you have a question or a comment, and you'd like to get it on the air, by all means, just drop a quick line to Margaret at mramsey@concord.edu. She'll get it to us, and we'll get the question or your comment on the air. Keith, anything else?
Did you want to talk something about Rotunda?
Yes.
Especially to those who are not
right.
Grand participants. I can put that up on
right.
The main page up on the screen for us.
One of the advantages for those who, the teachers know this, but those who are not enrolled in the program as teachers may not know this as yet. One of the things that we've been able to do in this grant is to purchase the license to the Rotunda, R-O-T-U-N-D-A, the Rotunda American Founding Era Collection from the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia. And what that and his group at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, all of these resources are available on the Internet through the Rotunda website. Our teachers who are enrolled students at Concord in this graduate course have direct access to Rotunda. What that means is that they have direct access to all the letters, all the papers, all the newspaper articles, all the laws, all the journal entries related to ratification of the Constitution that are included in the ratification project, as well as all the letters written by and received by John Adams, Alexander Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson, Dolly Madison, James Madison, George Washington, and to come are the papers of Chief Justice Marshall, John Marshall,
Andrew Jackson
will be made part. The papers of Andrew Jackson will be included in the Rotunda Project. All of these papers are available directly through Rotunda. Our teachers have access to that through the Concord University website. Those of you who are not enrolled teachers will need a special IP address in order to gain access to Rotunda as well. On our next chat, next Tuesday night, I will give you that IP address. What that means is that everybody listening will have direct access to the Rotunda Project and to the primary resource materials that are available in that project. I did some investigation at Concord, primarily through the library, as to what the ramifications might be of making this IP address available. And basically the answer is, the outcome will be, theoretically, that more people will be accessing Rotunda, which is really what Rotunda is supposed to be doing. That's the whole point of it. So obviously, Concord has agreed as part of this grant that it will pay for the annual license renewal of Rotunda. Obviously, if suddenly the Rotunda project is hit by 10,000 people who want access to the primary founding era documents, we'll be confronted with this huge problem, which is that the whole world will be into the primary sources, which is what we live for. So anyway, the bottom line is that next Tuesday night, I will make it a point to have the IP address, and I will give it to you here on this chat. And what that means is that by using this IP address, everybody will be able to gain direct access to the Rotunda Project. Now, every time you go in, there's a record made, not of you. We're not interested. We're not violating or compromising your privacy or anything. But ultimately, we'll know how many people have been in and out of that site. And so suddenly, if the number goes up from 6 to 600, that's great. If it goes from 6 to 6,000, that's even better. The other thing that we're going to do is that one of our goals in this project is to more closely connect our teachers with their local libraries. And in West Virginia, we have an organization called the Mountain Library Network. And all the libraries in West Virginia, all the public libraries, are linked together, are networked together through the Mountain Library Network and connected to the library at Concord University. What that means is that every local library in West Virginia potentially has access to Rotunda as well. And so what we told our teachers when we met with them a couple of weeks ago, and I'm repeating it now, is that every one of these teachers, when they walk into their local library, carries the IP address with them of access to Rotunda, which means that every one of our teachers, by making direct contact with their local library, is making Rotunda available to all the people potentially who use that library. So what we're about is making appreciation and understanding of the primary materials available to everybody. Now, we all know for years and years and years, everybody's always had library cards, but there's never a rush on the library. So the fact of the matter is everybody can have this IP address, but realistically, we can't expect that there's going to be a rush to understand the founders. But the fact of the matter is everybody will have that IP address. Everybody will have that access. And from now on, when people misquote the founders, or when people try to convince us that the founders said something they didn't say, or wrote something they didn't write, or meant something they didn't mean, we can do a little bit of back-checking on these folks. And basically, we can begin to call some of these people to account who have made a political career out of bastardizing the primary sources in this country and bastardizing its history, and I mean that, using it for their own political advantage and basically misinterpreting, by design, misinterpreting the intent and the thinking and the ideals of America's founders. So that's what we're about, is building this sense of appreciation and understanding of the founders and giving everybody involved here more direct access to the sources. So, again, that's really what Rotunda's about. And by the time we have our chat next Tuesday on the 11th, everybody who's listening will have access to the Rotunda collection. I keep saying at Concord, but it's not at Concord. It's a digital. It's electronic. It's in cyberspace. It's somewhere out there. So it's not anywhere. It's everywhere. And all we've got to do is connect people to it.
And it's so different than, you know, going to a library and looking at the letters of George Washington in so many volumes and trying to use indexes and things like that to find particular letters. With this particular resource, you basically, if you go into the page for George Washington, you can search it. I mean, you can look at diaries, you can look at the colonial letters, you can look by chronology, content, there's indexes, you can search. You can search even in terms of recipients. If I'm looking for letters that Washington wrote to William Crawford, I found a particular one. I used in one of my own classes concerning Washington's opinion of the Proclamation of 1763, one that you see quoted in I don't know how many textbooks, which Washington says to Crawford that anyone who doesn't take advantage of the opportunity of surveying good lands in the Ohio River Valley will lose that forever. Mm-hmm. If they actually mean that, he basically denounces the Proclamation line, saying that it's just a temporary expedient to quiet the minds of Indians. And so that's quoted in, I don't know how many textbooks, but I was able to find the entire letter. Mm-hmm. And one thing you find when you read the entire letter as opposed to a quote in a textbook is you get the entire context, and you find sometimes that things that are not included in the quote in the textbook are actually very important. Mm-hmm. and can be very useful to you. And I think this is part of a great general trend in terms of primary source material. So much of it is going to become more and more available. I mean, I think the Benjamin Franklin Papers, as I think we pointed out last year in one of our chats, is already free and everyone has access to it. The Peter Forces American Archives, which I know you're familiar with.
Yeah, very much so.
And when you used them at the University of Wisconsin when you were a graduate student, you had to use the hard copy and you had to use indexes and all those kinds of things. For Civil War history, the official records, the OR, Cornell University has it available for everyone. They can do bullion searches. Mm-hmm. You can find particular places, even here in southern West Virginia, mm-hmm. And find out what happened in the American Civil War right here in this particular place. And so and it's incredibly exciting. Yeah. And so, therefore, there's also a great responsibility in a sense that there is no reason why anybody should be fooled on any issue of American history, since it is so readily available for us. So there's no excuse for that. So we should know that Lexington and Concord were not in New Hampshire, but they are in Massachusetts. We should know that. You know, that shouldn't be something that
I think a potential political candidate for president kind of made that mistake, didn't
yeah, they? Well, yeah, yeah. That, but and that's just one of many kinds of things that come up, but that is just there for us. It's available for us, and not just for historians. And one thing that's happening in history right now, and you and I have talked about this before, is so much good history is being written by people who are not professors of history,
mm-hmm.
Journalists, and other folks. A lot of really good history. I remember reading Evan Thomas's book on Theodore Roosevelt and Henry Cabot Lodge.
Evan Thomas is great.
Yeah,
and John Meacham's.
Yeah, John Meacham's stuff is excellent. And that we're going to get better history, I think, because there's better access to the materials.
And of course, the key here is having a more sophisticated, a more intelligent audience for it. And basically, that's what we're hoping to help produce here. And that's what we're about. I was thinking when you were talking about Rotunda and its searchability that one of the things that John Kaminsky suggested when he was in here, as an example, everybody knows in the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And John raised the question when he was in, I wonder what the founders meant by happiness. And if you think about that, John gave us several examples. And if you think about that, not only did different people mean different things, but the meanings of words change through time. And one of the things that John suggested that you can do with Rotunda, for example, is pick one of the founders, like George Washington. He picked George Washington. But he said, just go on and Google on the Internet. Just Google happiness, in quotes, George Washington. And it'll give you a list of sources where George Washington talks about happiness. And you can basically look through the chronologically through the years and see how George Washington's view and appreciation and understanding of the concept of happiness evolves and changes through time.
You mean by doing a word search on
Rotunda? By doing a word search through Rotunda. And those are the kinds of things you can do. Or what did James Madison mean, you know, everybody talks about Federalism. Everybody doesn't talk about Federalism, but then I do. Let's be honest, I do. But
I knew it was going to happen. He had to mention it.
No, but the fact of the matter is,
he can't have lunch without mentioning it.
If you he's all over the place. But the fact of the matter is that you can basically look at the ideas that end up to be in Madison's Federalist Number 10. You can go back and see how they evolved in Madison's letters 2 and 3 years before he writes Federalist Number 10.
So you can look for faction.
Right.
You can do a search for faction.
Right. One of the things that I found, I was absolutely amazed when I was doing my research for my dissertation. There's a document that you can get right now on the Internet. Just go on Google and just Google Vices of the American Political System, James Madison. And what Madison does is list the weaknesses of American politics under the Articles of Confederation. So he writes this in 1786, a year before the Constitutional Convention, And he spells out, number one, number two, number three, the weaknesses of the political fabric in this country as he sees them under the Articles of Confederation. And you read that document, and then you read Federalist Number 10 the very next year, where Madison takes these ideas and refashions them into something that we know as one of the Federalist Papers, probably the most prominent Federalist paper. And you can begin to see how these ideas of Madison have evolved into policy in Federalist Number 10. But the most interesting thing is when you read his Vices of the American Political System, he's basically laying it out and saying, this is what I see is wrong in this area. This is what I see is wrong in that area. This is, I mean, it's just, he's not playing around. He's not playing with words. He's not trying to hide his real intent. He's just kind of laying it out for everybody to see. And once you understand that Madison wrote that document in 86, you can understand exactly what Federalist Number 10 means, because his Number 10 was a solution to those vices. So he lays out the problems. A year later, he comes up with a document. He said, here's the way you fix that. And with those two things together, side by side, what an education. It's the first and most meaningful textbook on American government that ever existed. Because there's the guy who wrote the Constitution explaining this is how the Constitution's going to solve these problems. And if you go back a year, here's my understanding of what those problems are. Yeah. Fabulous stuff.
Let me ask you a question. I've been teaching American history for 14 years. And you've taught American history for a long time.
More than 14 years.
More than 14 years.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen a textbook that basically lays out what you just laid out to us?
No.
In terms of Madison and that document before Federalist 10? The emphasis is always on Federalist 10.
No, but what I was going to say is when I was doing my research, now this would have been in the 1972, 1973, I came across in Madison's own handwriting his vices of the American political system. And when I saw it and found it, I didn't know it existed. It turned out that there were a few people that did know that it existed, but I didn't. And here I was speculating and trying to figure out what Madison's thinking was going into the Constitutional Convention. I was trying to basically come up with a research topic, a dissertation topic. And I was trying to get my arms around what the Constitutional Convention was about. And here I found the guy that wrote the Constitution, at least the Virginia Plan, which was the heart of the Constitution. I find a paper that he wrote the year before in which he says, this is what I see that's wrong with American government. I couldn't believe it. And I remember going to seminar on a Monday after that and announcing to the seminar and said, I can't believe what I found in my research in Madison's handwriting. Well, my major professor, Merrill Jensen, he knew that Madison had written this, but nobody else in the seminar did. And everybody kept saying, oh, my God, do you know what you found? Do you know what you found? Well, of course, my first reaction was I found something that was worth money. But that wasn't true. It wasn't the Antiques Roadshow or anything like that. But what I did find was a perspective that helped me understand the Constitutional Convention like there's no other way to understand it. That Vices of the American Political System is one of the major documents in American history. If you go on Google and you just put Vices of the American Political System, James Madison, it'll just lay it out there. It's about a page and a half. And it is absolutely incredible. And anybody that reads that is going to understand the Constitution of the United States, because the Constitution was written to fix those vices. And then, of course, what Madison had to do throughout the convention was make compromises in order to get the thing passed. We see that going on in Congress right now, where they're trying to find ways to agree to get things passed. Well, that's what the Constitutional Convention was about, is the wheeling and dealing, as Madison tried to get as much of that through as he possibly could get through, without changing it or sacrificing major portions of it. But for me, it was an eye-opener, and I think it would be for people who see it. It is in the ratification papers on Rotunda. And if you go in there, I mean, there it is. And so, again, we think a fantastic resource here. And my purpose, my goal, is to try to make it as available to as many people as there are who want it. And so that's really kind of what we're about, Keith. How about we've been going an hour and 15 minutes. About 45 minutes.
Okay.
So far. I want to go through a little bit of the syllabus and kind of explain what we're hoping to do. Then we have a document that we're going to put up there. It's a Jefferson letter. We thought we'd play with that for a while because since we're talking about primary sources, we kind of thought that we would use this first chat session as an opportunity to kind of give people an idea as to what we hope you can do with primary sources. And so if you'll permit me, and I will make this available to Bob so he can put it on the head-on website as well. But one of the things that we're asking, and this is for the benefit of our teachers specifically, but for others as well, in terms of, now this is the class on the founding. This is the first third of the class. This is the syllabus. And as I mentioned, there are three goals that we have in this project. I'm going to read them, although I alluded to them already. The first one is to improve the content, knowledge, understanding, and appreciation of the region's K-12 American history teachers for the contributions of America's founders and the efforts of those who followed the founders to implement. My guess is you probably have something like this anyway. But if you don't, let me suggest what everybody ought to have, and that is a good textbook. Now, everybody knows that if you go to a college bookstore like Concord's or West Virginia University's or Marshall's or the University of Virginia's or anybody else's, and you go to the bookstore and you look at the prices of the textbooks for sale, questions that do not require answers but questions to think about. For example, we're talking about founding principles, the principles and values and ideals of our founders. So if we're doing that, then it stands to reason that we're talking about governance. We're talking about the relationship between government and its people. We're talking about theory. We're talking about political theory. We're talking about rights. We're talking about responsibilities. We're talking about accountability. We're talking about what's legal. We're talking about what's right. We're talking about what's illegal and what's wrong. In other words, we're basically trying to lay out exactly the kinds of thinking that our founders did on the nature of the political system that they tried to create in this society once independence from Great Britain became a reality. Let me just read you a couple of just thought questions. These are just reflective questions to think about as you read. Who makes the laws? Who makes the rules that we live by? Who doesn't? We are, according to everybody, everybody says this is a democracy. Is it? Does everybody make the rules? Does everybody follow the rules? Is everyone subject to the same rules, the so-called rule of law? Are laws and rules administered equally? Is everybody equally accountable to the rules and to the laws under which we live? Are the laws and rules administered fairly? The first question was equally. The second question is fairly. If some are held to criteria that others are not held to, what factors determine this particular individual status or influence? What considerations are important in explaining the people's requirement to obey the law? Why do people obey? Are there some people who refuse to obey? What motivates them? How do they get away with disobeying the law? Or do they? Which people or groups of people seem most likely to benefit from or be hurt by the rules and the laws and the policies and the programs and the philosophies or the proposals that are being enacted into law. Who wins? Who loses? One of the best textbooks, it wasn't a great textbook, but the title of it was fantastic, is an introductory course in American government that I taught in the 1970s in Virginia. And the title of the textbook was, Who Gets the Cookies? What a fabulous title for a textbook on American government. Who wins? Who loses? Because the bottom line is the law really ever neutral? We talk about rule of law, and we are a nation of laws rather than a nation, rather than of men. You know, we all are susceptible to the rule of law. And the question is that true? Is everybody equal under the law? Is everybody treated fairly under the law? Is the law neutral? If certain people want a law, is there a way that they will benefit personally from that law if it's passed? If some people are opposed to a certain law, are they liable to be hurt by that law? Who wins? Who loses? Who wants? Who doesn't want? How does government make the decision on which side to come down on between those who want the law and those who don't want the law? How does government decide between competing ideologies and competing wants and diswants? Is it possible to change things for the better by changing the law? To put that another way, is it possible to change the law from within? Or is the only real way to change the law from without? If you look at what's going on throughout the Middle East today in country after country, what we are seeing is the playing out of a philosophy which says the only way to change the status quo is from outside, not from inside. Traditionally, the distinction between liberals and radicals is that traditionally liberals have always been advocates for change, but usually change from within the system. What makes radicals radicals in the past has been that they are usually disenchanted liberals who have decided that you can't change it from within. The only way to change it is to get outside and hammer away at it. All right, what am I saying? I'm saying that if you start to think about some of these questions as you read about what the founders were talking about, as the kind of government they wanted to set up in place of being colonies of Great Britain, many of these questions. Did the founders really want a society in which people were really equal? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. And among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Did the founders really believe that? They said it. They wrote it. They fought a war for independence, theoretically, to bring it about. But there's a serious question as to whether they wanted it. There's no question that some of them didn't want it. There's serious suggestion that more didn't want it than did want it. And those who did want it were your radicals. And so the question I'm saying is, as you reflect on these kinds of questions, as you read the textbook, none of these are answered in the textbook. Every one of them help us understand what is written in that textbook. Because the textbook is based on what becomes law. Not who's behind it, what the intent behind it is, or anything else. That requires the thinking reader, the thinking person, and that's what we're trying to create. And then there were questions here about the colonies and about East and Western colonies. Then there are questions about the empire, the relationship between the colonies and the mother country. And then there are questions about situations and relationships within the colonies themselves and the political situation within England itself. The colonies had real friends within England, for example. Edmund Burke being one of them. Major supporter of American independence. The fact that the American colonies had a right to be independent. I mean, I don't think anybody realized, many people realize this. And then the question of rights. Question. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Okay. Do individuals, do they really have certain rights? What are they? Does everybody have them? If everybody has them, can you lose them? Can you give them away? Where do these rights come from? How are they protected? From whom? If rights need protection, from whom do they need protection? Are people's rights linked to government? How? Is government a positive or is government a negative? Do the rights come from government or does government take away rights? Do rights come from God? Is government the enemy that takes away people's rights that they got from God? Where do rights come from? Is government viewed, again, as a positive or a negative? By everyone? Or just a few people who believe government is a positive or negative? Do individual rights gain or lose when government comes into the picture? I'm from the government and I'm here to help you, is the old expression. John Kaminsky claimed, when he was here, that the Charter of Liberties in Massachusetts, 1641, the Massachusetts Charter of Liberties, summed up pretty well all of the statements about and all the efforts to define human rights that followed. If you go on the Internet and Google the Massachusetts Charter of Liberties, 1641, you will find that in Massachusetts, in 1641, 135 years before the Declaration of Independence, the citizens of Massachusetts were laying out a list of rights in the Charter of Liberties that, according to John Kaminsky, who probably knows this period better than anybody else, says every Bill of Rights that ever came after that was based on that. That's one of the most important documents in all of history, is the Massachusetts Charter of Liberties.
And over 40 years before the English Bill of Rights.
Before the English Bill of Rights. 1641, people in America were already thinking about what their rights were and where they came from and what the role of government was in those rights. Did these people believe that government was the source of the rights, that government's job was to protect rights, or that government's job was to define and take rights away? In 1641, 135 years before the Declaration, citizens of Massachusetts are laying out in their Charter of Liberties the answers to these kinds of questions.
I think you could also refer our teachers and everyone to Tom Tierney's presentation.
Right.
This past summer as well, in terms of the philosophical.
Tom Tierney talked about the ideological origins of the founders. You know, basically Tierney's idea is, what were the founders reading? Where did the founders get their ideas from? Who were they reading? Locke and Hobbes and Montesquieu David Hume and many of the others. Basically, then, what we ask you to do, what we're asking our teachers to do, and what we invite you to do as well, is go to our website, go to the Head On website, and look in the archives. Look at the presentations, Keith Lilly's presentation, on the conflict between Native Americans and colonials and American colonials. Look at Tierney's presentation on Locke and Hobbes and Montesquieu and David Hume and Harrington and some of the others. Look at Bob Bliss's presentation on the differences between churches and who attended different churches, between the so-called New Lights at that time, the Methodists and the Baptists and the Quakers, the Puritan heritage in New England, and the kinds of documents that Bliss shared with us. Look at the videos of John Kaminsky talking about the colonies on the eve of American independence. Finally, we've got a number of primary documents listed here on the website, including the Massachusetts Charter of Liberties, the English Declaration of Rights of 1689. I've got on this list the initial 1606 charter for the colony of Virginia and the second charter for the colonies of Virginia in 1609 and the third charter of the colony of Virginia in 1611 and the fourth charter of the colonies of Virginia in 1621. Now, you're probably saying, why, who would care about four charters given to the Virginia Company between 1606 and 1621. What I'm suggesting to you is if you lay out these charters, you can get on the inside, you can get into the head of British policymakers, and you can actually see how their ability to manage a colonial empire is evolving. Because in each of these charters, they become more specific on what rights are retained in the mother country, what rights are going to be allowed within Virginia, and ultimately what they are doing is laying out their understanding of how to manage an empire. In 1606 to 1621. So if you were going to answer a question about the relations between mother country and colonies, what better way to do it than go back and look at how the English thought through what they had to do in order to manage their colonial empire. And you can see it in these charters.
So if they were dealing with those particular documents, would you recommend, for example, that they use the textbook that they've selected and all the events in the textbook, you know, from the founding of Jamestown through the Plymouth Colony, all the way Bacon's Rebellion, all the way through into the 18th century, all these events, and see those documents in context of those events.
Right.
So the purpose of the textbook is essentially to give you that context.
To give you the broad picture.
And then you can see those documents, and you can see really what they're in response to, therefore.
Right. And more than that, you're beginning to see what it was that Great Britain was trying to do by founding colonies and what they were learning. Obviously, if they issued a charter in 1606 and they turned around and issued another one in 1609, then something bad must have happened between 1606 and 1609. It wasn't working. So then they issue the one in 1609. 3 years later in 1612, they issue a third one. So what you're beginning to see is that as England responds to changing circumstances in the colonies and in their efforts to manage the colonies, they are learning. And they are devising revisions in policy, in management policy. Once you understand that, then you read that textbook and the whole thing begins to make sense. Once you understand what England is about, then you can begin to understand why they do what they do with the colonies. And as the colonies react, why England in certain cases lays down the law, so to speak. And in other cases said, well, let's let them just do what they want to do. That's the so-called salutary neglect idea. Better that they stay with us, even if they're, you know, keep them happy, rather than lay the law down, make them unhappy, and then we got a bigger problem on our hands. So there's different strategies. Is England going to be a hard, strict taskmaster, or is England going to be the very liberal, loosey-goosey manager who lets the colonies do what they want? Once you begin to look at these charters and you begin to see these things reflected, then you can read colonial history and you really understand it.
It's certainly not the emphasis that you're wanting, that you're really kind of dealing with here. But, you know, I was kind of thinking that says just about as much about England as it does about America.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the changes that are going on in England with the Stuarts and then, of course, eventually with the English Civil War in the 1640s. And that's important in terms of, you know, people coming to America anyway. The people who leave England for Virginia in 1607, 1608,
right.
1609 are leaving a different England than the people who leave England in 1624 when Charles is king. So, I mean, that's you can also kind of see it from that perspective as well, what's going on in England.
Yeah.
So all these things kind of play in together.
Right. But it's basically what I'm suggesting to our teachers
is
that depending on where you're going and what it is you want, that will dictate which of these documents you want to emphasize and which you don't. So if you decide that you're going to do a and I'll share with you very quickly the questions in this unit, and then we'll let Keith go into the, you know, into the 19th century
right.
one. But basically what I'm suggesting is that if you decide to do a question that relates to England and the colonies and the origins of the War for Independence, then basically what England's intent was and what their policies were in managing the colonies would become critical in your, you know, to your understanding of that issue. So you'd want to read certain documents, but other documents you wouldn't. So if you're doing one with rights, you'd want to deal with the documents, the primary sources related to individual rights, like the Charter of Liberties. So again, it depends on where you're going. And I'll get done here very quickly. There are reading assignments in here with the books, but the point I want to make is I've asked four questions in this unit, and I'm asking our teachers, and this is not due until December, so when we come back, we'll actually, into our second chat, we'll actually address these questions in some detail. But let me give you an idea of the questions that I've asked, and then I'll turn this over to Keith. In the first question, this question addresses the issue of human rights, responsibilities, and freedoms, the specifics of what they are, where they came from, and what people can and should do to secure and protect those rights. In 1775, Alexander Hamilton addressed in a pamphlet called The Farmer Refuted the critical issues of rights as these seem to have emerged as the key issue between the mother country and the colonies. If you think about what you know about the American Revolution, the issue seemed to come down to colonial rights versus the English right, you know, the right of the mother country to rule. And this is what Hamilton says in his pamphlet, The Farmer Refuted. The sacred rights of mankind, he says, are not to be rummaged for among old parchments or musty record. They are written as with a sunbeam in the whole volume of human nature by the hand of divinity itself and can never be erased or obscured by mortal power. The implication is that Hamilton says these rights come from someplace other than the mother country. And therefore, the mother country doesn't have the right to trample them, is what he's basically suggesting. So here's my question. As we reflect on these issues in the 1770s, at a time when Americans are well along in their determination to stand up to a mother country, which seems hell-bent on trampling on colonial rights and freedoms, what givens did Americans bring to the table? More specifically, did the rights and the freedoms that they cared most about come from God? Come from the king? English common law and English history? Common sense? Or a combination of all of these? Were their arguments in defense of their views and their actions consistent? Were they sincere? More political than philosophical? Were they a product of changing circumstances? When Americans declared their right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in 1776, what particular rights were they really concerned about? Or were different people thinking about different rights? That's the question. That's one question. So what I'm asking for is the product of your reflection and your thinking on that subject. That'll include some of the primary documents. It'll include reading the textbook, et cetera, et cetera. All right, the second question is a quote from John Adams. The American Revolution was effected before the war commenced, he wrote. The revolution was in the minds and the hearts of the people. A change in their religious sentiments, in their duties and obligations. This radical change in the principles, opinions, sentiments, and affections of the people was the real American Revolution. And what I'm asking, do you agree with Adams or do you disagree? And again, as you formulate your answer, think always about how you would teach this to kids. Third question, one of my favorites. You are a trusted member of Lord North's cabinet. You were appointed to your post in 1770 when Lord North first came aboard, and you continue to serve him and your king well into the so-called American Revolution. Here's the question. It is early 1776. you know that the situation in America has deteriorated to the point that independence is being talked about everywhere. You know what has happened between mother country and colonies, both the good and the bad. Lord North has asked you, as his trusted advisor, to make policy recommendations designed to preserve the empire and resolve some of the most outstanding differences between mother country and her North American colonies. Present your report to Lord North. What would you recommend to Lord North to hold the empire together, knowing as you do what happened? And then the last question. Assess events in the ongoing crisis between England's North American colonies and the mother country between 1763 and 1776 from the perspective of republicanism as colonial thinkers and writers defined the term during this period. So I'm asking you to write the story of the events between 1763 and 1776 leading to independence from the perspective of republicanism. In order to answer that question, you're going to have to read from Gordon Wood's book, Radicalism of the American Revolution, which you have on your Kindles. So those are the kinds of questions. You don't answer those out of textbooks, folks. You really need to do some thinking and some digging. We're asking our teachers to submit answers to two of those four questions, and they have until December, the first part of December, to do. So that's really kind of where we're coming from. It gives you an idea is what we're hoping to accomplish in these classes. That's the founding course. Keith, you've done – okay, let me make an announcement here because it's 5 till 9. We're going to be breaking away from the Horn audio stream for the Rick Smith Show. So those people listening to the audio on Head On will go into Rick Smith. Those people that are tuning us in through Ustream will just keep on going. We have another half hour to go. You can always get the chats on the Ustream page. Everything is being archived. Everything will be there. So even if you have to, if you go away, you can come back to the archive and get the rest of this. And Keith, why don't you?
And also, I'll put that on Blackboard as well. So we'll have a link to Blackboard. We also have an email here, and Pam Jackson's emailed us, and she wanted us to know that she's in the middle school parking lot listening to us on the wireless. So I guess she's going to lose us here in a little bit, right? She's going to lose us, and she'll go to the other program. But she's been listening to us on the wireless, and she wanted us to know that she was listening to us. And Pam's a great teacher.
Yeah, Pam's one of our best people.
I've been to her classroom. I've seen her in action, so I know. Just how effective she is. And so I just want to say hi, Pam.
Hey, Pam.
She can't see me.
But you're in the parking lot. It's cold out there, Pam. Yeah. Pam is in Monroe County. She teaches
right.
in Monroe County. And
James Monroe High School.
And lucky Monroe County. She's one of the best teachers we have.
In fact, that's generally true.
Yeah. We've got the best. The very best.
In terms of what we're doing with the 19th century course, I'm going to be kind of brief because I know you want to look at this document a little. But we're going to have a little bit of a different type of a course. We're going to have fewer assignments in terms of the individual units. The first unit's already up there. I have all the documents, the questions, the assignment. It's already available. Very traditional, Age of Jackson. It basically, I copped one from Schlesinger. So
yep.
The Age of Jackson. And there also is going to be a unit on the origins of the Civil War. We're really thinking about the sectional crisis. Especially produced by expansion and the idea of will slavery extend and expand or not, and how that leads up to eventually to the secession crisis. There will be a unit on the war itself, and all of these can be tied back, obviously, to the founding principles. I mean, if you're thinking even about the war itself, I mean, I'm teaching a Civil War history course right now, an undergraduate course, and we're talking quite a bit about the whole concept of the role of the chief executive in terms of war powers and things of that nature, being commander in chief, and so all of that could be tied to many of the possible topics that we could look at in terms of the war itself, and then we'll also have a unit on Reconstruction as well, and so we have the first one's already there, the documents are already up for you to read. probably the most important aspect, however, of the 19th century course is a research project that we have. Each student, or each, I shouldn't say student, each teacher,
teacher.
Really, each participant,
students.
Really.
We're all students here.
Is going to essentially write a paper. And I'm not seeing this as a paper like necessarily, you know, a research paper for a course, so much as I, what I'm thinking is this is research they're going to do, they're going to make available to their colleagues.
Yeah.
And so the idea is that when this is all said and done, and in the spring when they turn this in, we are going to take these papers, we're going to take these works of history, right, these secondary sources that they produce, and we're going to bind these in some kind of a binder or something of that nature. We're going to make these available to all the other teachers in the program. We have approval from Dr. Rao that he will accept a copy into the Concord Library. And so students from this point on forever will be able to use these as secondary sources and history courses for years to come. And so it's a contribution. Basically what we're doing is we're going to produce our own book, a series of essays, on 19th century America. And what I included in the document that I gave everybody over the summer, and it's also on Blackboard, is I basically laid out the requirements, you know, what we're really expecting in terms of those papers, in terms of argument, use of primary sources, the actual physical look of the paper, because we want them all to be the same, so that we can use them, obviously, in this binder we're putting together. And I had a list of...